This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most operational franchise of al-Qaeda today is the Yemen-based al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, according to John Brennan, President Obama's counterterrorism advisor. He describes the group as very, very dangerous. Several terrorist plots originated there, including the recent underwear bomb plot, which was just exposed by a double agent. The radical U.S.-born Muslim preacher Anwar al-Awlaki was killed by a U.S. drone in Yemen last year. He developed a following on the Internet and was able to preach to English-speaking people. The Obama administration has escalated its drone attacks in Yemen, and the U.S. is now providing logistical support to the Yemeni military. But Yemen is a country you don't hear that much about. One reason is that it's difficult for journalists to get in. My guest, Jeremy Scahill, was in Yemen last January and has been writing about its militant groups, civil wars, and the relationship between Yemen and the U.S. Scahill is the national security correspondent for The Nation and author of the bestseller Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy Scahill, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why is Yemen considered to pose perhaps the greatest threat of terrorism to the United States?
Well, after 9/11 and the decimation of the Taliban government, al-Qaeda operatives started to flee the country. And it's very famously, many of them ended up inside of Pakistan. But over the course of the years following 9/11, a number of al-Qaeda operatives ended up going to Somalia and Yemen. And in the mid-2000s, there were only a few hundred operatives of al-Qaeda. In fact, the group wasn't even called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And they were just kind of laying low, and they weren't posing much of a threat to anyone, not the government in Yemen and not the United States. But then in 2009, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was formed, and some of the members of that organization had an external jihadist agenda to attack both Saudi Arabia and the United States. And because of the connection of AQAP to things like the attempted underwear bombing on Christmas of 2009 and the parcel bomb plots, you know, it really sort of came to be that it was a primary place on the U.S. radar. And U.S. officials are sort of nuanced in how they've talked about it. They say it's the greatest external threat facing the U.S. homeland in terms of terrorism.
There's been some recent threats from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, and one of them was that second underwear bombing. Now, it turned out that the bomber was a double agent who is a Saudi-British national, but just refresh our memory about this plot that was just thwarted this month.
Well, there are a number of notorious sort of infamous Saudi bomb makers that are residing in Yemen. One of them, Asiri, is known to have made bombs that could be placed inside the human body. In fact, one of his operatives tried to kill one of the Saudi princes who was the intelligence chief in 2009 with an explosive that appeared to have been actually inserted into his body. There was the infamous attempt to take down an airliner over the United States Christmas of 2009. By this Nigerian young man named Abdul Farouk Abdul Muttalib. And he had this somewhat crude but also advanced underwear bomb that many terrorism analysts say could have brought down that plane if it was correctly executed. And so then in recent weeks, we've learned of this what is reported to be a disrupted plot, an attempt for AQAP once again to send someone onto an airliner with a more sophisticated version of that underwear bomb. And the reports that we have is that it was broken up by this agent. But I feel like I need to say, Terry, that I haven't done my own reporting on this. And while I trust my colleagues, particularly from the Associated Press, who've done a good job in reporting the story, I'm not entirely convinced that we have a full understanding of how this plot was broken up and who the agent that allegedly broke it up actually is.
What are your questions?
Well, I mean, I think that you have to realize that Yemen is just a cauldron of chaos when it comes to intelligence. And you have a number of forces that have their hands deeply invested in Yemen. The Saudis have thousands of people on their payrolls, and they pay off tribal leaders. And the United States actually has a pretty weak intelligence presence on the ground when it comes to human intelligence. And the United States has sort of outsourced its intelligence operations in Yemen to Saudi Arabia and Yemen's security forces. And we've seen repeatedly over the past 10 years, the Saudis and the Yemenis manipulate events regarding al-Qaeda within Yemen to try to curry favor with the United States or to get more funding. And so I just would sort of reserve commentary as a reporter who's covered Yemen extensively and been there on going too far down the line of guessing who this agent was, who he was working for, and what he actually did, because I've seen it too many times where someone's getting played or someone's getting spun. I mean, look at the leaks that came out after bin Laden and all of the information that we thought was true because it was coming from the administration. And in reality, it wasn't coming from the men who conducted that operation. And now we learn details that contradict some of those earlier ones. So I guess it's more just learning a lesson as a reporter to let the facts fall before rushing to a judgment about them. And I think Yemen is so complicated that we, you know, a little bit of caution in concluding what exactly that operation looked like is called for.
So the U.S. has recently increased the number of its drone attacks in Yemen. And recently, through one of those attacks, it killed one of the men believed to have plotted the attack against the USS Cole in the port of Yemen in October 2000. Who was this guy?
Right. His name was Fahd al-Kusso. And it's sort of an interesting story because he was clearly involved with the plot to bomb the USS Cole. But his job that day was not to drive one of the boats to attack the USS Cole, but rather to film the bombing as it happened, to use it for propaganda purposes. And he actually overslept and didn't make it in time to actually film the bombing. But over the past decade, since the Cole was bombed, he sort of has been one of the influential elders of the al-Qaeda movement within Yemen. And has sort of acted as a mentor to some of the younger operatives. And he's infamous and famous for his role in the Cole bombing. And he had been arrested at one point by Yemen, and the United States was pursuing him as one of its most wanted terror suspects around the world. And then a few years ago, he went totally underground. He popped up a few months ago and gave an interview to a Yemeni journalist. And then the U.S. apparently tracked him down and killed him in a drone strike. And we know for certain that he's dead because al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula released a martyr bio of him. It's interesting, Terry, about AQAP and al-Qaeda in general. They often do confirm the deaths of their leaders. They generally don't lie about that, and they will issue martyr bios for these people. So it's pretty clear that Fahd al-Kusso was killed and was killed by a U.S. drone strike.
I guess I do that because it's such a good thing to be a martyr.
Well, I do think that, you know, there's this saying
in their
I've
eyes.
Heard,
I'm not endorsing.
No, I understand. No, I understand what you're saying. It is interesting. From Afghanistan to Somalia to Yemen, I've heard similar things from various insurgent groups or Islamist militant movements, and they often will say, "We love death like you love life," meaning you, the Western world. We're not afraid to die, and you cling to your life as your most prized possession. And it's an interesting window into that mentality.
So, you know, somebody else killed by a drone strike in the recent past was Anwar al-Awlaki, the radical cleric who is American-born, used YouTube to get famous and spread his radical message. And he was an American citizen. So that was a drone attack, too? And he was a member of AQAP.
Well, yes to your first question. I mean, that it was a drone attack, and we believe from the information that's been made public that it was a CIA drone attack rather than the U.S. military running the operation. So it meaning that it was a very targeted strike, and he's been on a CIA and Joint Special Operations Command hit list, as far as we know, since late 2009 when the U.S. first tried to kill him. On the issue of AQAP, I've spent time with Anwar al-Awlaki's family. I interviewed journalists that are very close to al-Qaeda in Yemen and talked to them about this question. And I think it's more complex than simply stating that he was a member of al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I would say that he was a guy that was radicalized by his experience after 9/11. He was a preacher who actually was saying things that many secular anti-war activists were saying about the sameness of violence, that the attacks on Washington and New York did not justify the deaths of civilians in Afghanistan or Iraq any more than the deaths of Palestinians or Iraqis justify the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And his family members will even acknowledge that they believe he was pushed into the al-Qaeda fold. And so you can draw a trajectory where he gets more and more radical as the campaign against him intensifies, as he's locked up in prison, as the drone strikes begin, to the point where one of his last videos, Terry, is Anwar al-Awlaki sitting in front of the al-Qaeda flag and basically daring Barack Obama to invade Yemen. So was he a member of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula at the end of his life? It's entirely possible. But I think his story is more complicated than simply saying, well, he joined al-Qaeda and therefore he was a legitimate target. He was never, to our knowledge, charged with any crime in a U.S. court. And so I think it raises a lot of really serious issues about the direction we're going in as a nation. And let's remember, another American citizen was killed alongside him, a young man named Samir Khan, who is from North Carolina, a Pakistani-American. And then 2 weeks later, Anwar al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, who also is a U.S. citizen, born in Colorado, was killed in another U.S. strike. And it's unclear who the target of that strike even was.
What questions does it raise when a drone attack kills somebody in Yemen who is actually an American citizen, if they're plotting against America?
Right. I mean, the first question that as a journalist I would ask, and many constitutional lawyers are asking, is if you believe that this American citizen has done something that is a crime or an act of war against the United States, explain it. Indict him, charge him with a crime, demand his extradition. The United States never charged him to our knowledge, it's never been made public, with any crime. So to me, taking off a journalism hat for a second and just as an American citizen, it's deeply troubling that we don't know how American citizens end up on what are essentially hit lists. And it raises constitutional questions. It raises moral questions. It was President Ford coming out of the era of assassinations and coups of the 60s and 70s and the scandals with the CIA and Watergate. It was Gerald Ford who issued an executive order banning the United States and its employees from committing assassinations. And every president since has upheld that executive order. But this administration has taken it to the extreme and basically has declared the world a battlefield. And anyone that is determined by some committee within the National Security Council to represent a national security threat to the United States is an enemy combatant.
So who makes up the list of targets? It's the National Security Council?
Well, no one knows exactly how this is determined, and this is the subject of litigation from the American Civil Liberties Union and other legal organizations. What I understand from the reporting that I've done on this is that we have a committee that is embedded somewhere within the National Security Council, and they vet these lists of people that are potential targets. And some of these individuals come through the Joint Special Operations Command, which is the premier elite U.S. military unit pursuing terrorists around the world. They'll propose military targets, or the CIA will propose targets to this committee within the National Security Council. And sometimes the president signs off on them, as in the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, but there's a pre-cleared list of people, and this has been true since the early days after 9/11. There's a pre-cleared list of people that, if they are found, they can be killed on site.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Jeremy Scahill, and he's the national security correspondent for The Nation. He's also the author of the bestseller from a few years ago, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Jeremy Scahill. He's the national security correspondent for The Nation. He's also the author of the bestseller, Blackwater. And he's been doing a lot of reporting about Yemen. He was in Yemen last January. U.S. drone strikes in Yemen have escalated in the past few days. 11 militants were reported killed on Saturday in Yemen by a U.S. drone strike. What do you know about those 11 people?
Well, first of all, I'm very skeptical of reports that say, 11 suspected militants were killed, because we don't have reporters on the ground that are going to the scene and are evaluating who was killed. The United States is relying entirely on its own imagery from its drones and satellites, as well as intelligence on the ground from Yemeni military officials and Yemeni government officials and intelligence officials who have an agenda to make sure that the United States believes that all the people that they're killing are suspected militants rather than, say, an important tribal leader. And I bring that case up because there was a case where it appears as though the regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president of Yemen, fed the United States bad intel telling the U.S. that there's al-Qaeda group meeting in a particular area, and they killed an important tribal leader who happened to be an opponent of the regime. So that's sort of a long-winded way, Terry, of saying that I'm not saying that those people were not al-Qaeda operatives or that they weren't militants. But what I'm saying is we have no way of independently verifying who these people are that were killed. Colleagues of mine who are in the south of Yemen right now and are on really the front lines of this drone war. My friend Iona Craig, who's a great reporter for the Times of London, was just saying to me that that she met civilians who were severely burned from the drone strikes, and that one civilian that she talked to said there were 26 people killed in the strike that he survived and was severely burned in. So I think because we don't have reporters there, the door is wide open for propaganda about who's being killed. Certainly there's an al-Qaeda presence in Yemen. Certainly there are people that would love to bring down a U.S. airplane and are hell-bent on trying to destroy any U.S. interests that they can. But there are also a tremendous number of innocent people, the vast majority in the South, innocent people that are now living under an increasing bombardment. And I'm very concerned about the prospect for blowback in our operations in Yemen.
What kind of blowback are you concerned about?
Well, when I was in Yemen earlier this year, I managed to – this was before this escalation really started, but I saw it in its early stages. I made it into Abyan province, which is really one of the central places where this fighting is happening now. And what I was hearing as I traveled around the south of Yemen were reports from tribal leaders, from civilians, even from sort of pro-U.S. government officials within the Yemeni government that American bombs were not hitting the right targets, that there were cluster munitions, these sort of flying landmines, if you will, that were laying unexploded in various villages around the south in Yemen. And many Yemenis were very angry at the strikes that had already taken place and had stories of civilians being killed. In fact, one Yemeni tribal leader, Terry, told me, how is it that I can go and see Waheshi, the leader of AQAP, sitting in a restaurant in Shebwa province and no one drone strikes him, but you hit a village full of Bedouins that had nothing to do with al-Qaeda? Like, who's giving you your target list? And I heard that over and over and over. And so you have this situation now where because the strikes have not been precise, and the Obama administration started bombing Yemen in December of 2009, because they have not been precise in many cases and have killed civilians, what I saw was Yemenis starting to say, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. If the United States is saying that they're fighting AQAP, but they're killing our children and our grandchildren and our wives, then we're terrorists too.
We've been talking about U.S. drone attacks in Yemen targeting terrorists and suspected terrorists. It's not just drone attacks that the U.S. is using now to target terrorists. What are some of the other ways that our military presence in Yemen is expanding?
Well, in the past week, Terry, the United States military announced quietly, but announced that it was sending U.S. trainers back into Yemen. Somewhere between 50 and 100 U.S. soldiers are going to be on the ground in Yemen, operating alongside of Yemen's military and security forces. The U.S. basically created a counterterrorism unit in Yemen made up of Yemeni soldiers. And U.S. Special Forces troops for years have been in Yemen building up these units. And the idea behind it was that the U.S. didn't want to send troops into Yemen, but believed that there was a substantial threat posed by al-Qaeda figures and groups in Yemen. And so they wanted to encourage the Yemeni government to start taking a more active role in actually hunting down and killing these people. But what happened, Terry, is that these forces that the U.S. built up, and it began in the mid-2000s, ended up not fighting terrorism, but actually defending the failing regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh. So they were never operating in the territories where al-Qaeda figures were believed to be, but rather being used to defend the U.S.-backed regime of Saleh as it was crumbling to pieces. And so there was a lot of resentment from Yemenis. They call them the Saleh family military, the U.S.-backed units. They call them the Saleh family military, not the national military. Anyway, so the U.S. builds up that. They have trainers on the ground. And then you have a network of Saudi informants that are inside of Yemen. And then you have U.S. air power in the form of drones, as we've mentioned, but also cruise missiles that are being launched off the coast of Yemen from vessels or submarines that are there ostensibly to fight pirates in the Gulf of Aden. And there have been a number of Tomahawk cruise missile strikes. In fact, the most deadly strike that we know of in Yemen to date, authorized by the Obama administration, was his first strike in Yemen. And that was on December 17th, 2009. And it was not the CIA and it was not a drone. It was cruise missiles launched from the sea, and it slammed into this village called Al-Majla, which is in South Yemen. And the U.S. had intelligence that was given to it by the Yemeni government that there was an al-Qaeda training camp there and storage facilities for weapons. Well, it turned out that that wasn't true. And the U.S. bombed this village and killed 46 people. And we know the names of all of the people that were killed. I went there myself. I interviewed a woman who lost her entire family, an old man. 17 of those 46 people that were killed were members of his family. There were 5 pregnant women among the dead. It was a huge scandal in Yemen. And what ended up happening is that when the WikiLeaks cables came out, we discovered that General David Petraeus, who's now the director of the CIA, was in a meeting with the president of Yemen shortly after that strike, where they conspired to cover up the fact that it was a U.S. bombing. And the Yemeni president famously told Petraeus, according to this U.S. cable, "We'll continue to lie and say the bombs are ours and not yours." And that kicked off, that bombing, Terry, kicked off a sustained almost 3 years of bombing by the United States in Yemen in the form of drones, cruise missile strikes, and the backing of these so-called elite counterterrorism units that actually have done very little to fight terrorism and a lot to fight the pro-democracy movement in Yemen.
Jeremy Scahill is the national security correspondent for The Nation. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Jeremy Scahill, the national security correspondent for The Nation. We're talking about the terrorist threat to the U.S. from Yemen and the increasing U.S. drone attacks and military presence in Yemen. The group Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is based in Yemen. The country's president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was considered an ally of the U.S. in fighting terrorism, stepped down in February after months of protests against him. He'd been in power for 33 years. The man who had been Saleh's vice president, Abdrabba Mansour al-Hadi, is now the president. What kind of agreement did the Obama administration have with President Saleh while Saleh was still in office?
Well, first of all, I think we need to understand, you know, anyone who knows anything about Yemen or has spent time there or followed its history knows that Ali Abdullah Saleh is a master chess player. And he knows Yemen far better than the United States knows Yemen. And so he was able to kind of create a relationship with the United States where he essentially convinced both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, "I'm your buddy when it comes to terrorism. I'm going to give you free access to this country. You can do strikes against al-Qaeda people, but I want you to build up our military forces here." And Saleh essentially made an agreement with the Obama administration to get an increase in his counterterrorism funding in return for allowing the United States to conduct various operations of its own unilaterally. And so effectively, counterterrorism funding for his regime became like crack cocaine. Yemen is the poorest country in the Arab world. His government was extremely corrupt. This was their cash cow, claiming that they were fighting terrorism. And so what you've seen over the past 10, 12 years of history between the United States and Yemen is Ali Abdullah Saleh, when it was convenient for him, allowing the al-Qaeda threat to flare up, looking the other way when 23 al-Qaeda people broke out of a prison that they were supposed to be held in, actually allowing weapons to be smuggled into al-Qaeda areas so that they would attack a police station, and then coming back to the United States and saying, "Oh, we really need more funding to go and fight these terrorists." I mean, it may sound cynical, but that anyone who's been studying Yemen knows it's 100% true. It's kind of crazy that he was playing this game. And the United States played into it to the point where even when the world was seeing the brutality of that regime, the gunning down of protesters in the streets, a few months before Ali Abdullah Saleh fell, John Brennan, the senior counterterrorism advisor to the president, said that relations between the two governments had never been stronger.
There's a new president in Yemen now, and he's the former vice president from the Saleh government, and his name is Abdrabba Mansour Hadi. So what do you know about him?
Well, you know, I was in Yemen right before the quote-unquote election took place that put Hadi in power. And I say quote-unquote election because I don't believe that asking people to vote yes or no is actually an election. And there was only one candidate there. And it was sort of hilarious to see the fact that his party actually spent money campaigning when he had no opponent. So, you know, he was a guy who was part of the old system and had – I wouldn't say he defected to the opposition, but he had started to flirt with the Yemeni opposition. opposition when it became clear Saleh's regime was going to fall. And I think that it there was a mediated solution between the very powerful tribal sheikhs that that make up the opposition and the Saleh regime and his political party and his family, that Hadi would be an acceptable figure to both sides in the transition, because Saleh would still be allowed to keep his control through his family over the security and intelligence forces, and also to read Hadi the Riot Act if he was going too strongly against something that Saleh believed in. And then for the opposition, it was really their only way to get Saleh out. Their priority was, like, he can't be president anymore. So Yemen is in a position right now where I think that there's a lot of forces vying for power. And for Saleh and his people, Hadi was an acceptable candidate because he wasn't going to clean house and was going to keep in place the key figures who have been supported by the United States in the fight against al-Qaeda. It's interesting because Saleh's family members still run all of the most elite and powerful intelligence and military units in the country, and they're very close to the U.S. counterterrorism leadership.
So the U.S. is using drone attacks now to target militants in Yemen, suspected terrorists. And we have a military ground presence, a small one, but a military ground presence there. We're not at war with Yemen. How would you describe our relationship with Yemen?
I think that we're seeing the future of U.S. war fighting in Yemen. I think this is the model that has emerged over the past decade, where President Obama wants to draw down large-scale military occupations, as in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we are going to be, for decades to come, fighting a special operations forces, CIA, war of attrition against terrorism or against anyone determined to be an enemy of the United States. And I think Yemen is very symbolic of the direction we're heading in terms of U.S. national security policy. The relationship with Yemen right now is one where the United States is dealing with the fact that for a decade plus, it supported a regime that was pilfering the resources of the country, repressing its own people, jailing journalists, cracking down on pro-democracy demonstrators, and stealing from people across the country. And on the other hand, the United States escalating its bombing campaign. There's an elite class within Yemen that goes to conferences called Friends of Yemen and looks at World Bank studies and International Monetary Fund, but that's just the elite. To the average Yemeni, the United States must seem like a strange friend, supporting the worst among its people and then dropping bombs that so often don't seem to hit the right target. And I think that is going forward, going to be a big part of how the relationship between rural poor Yemenis and the United States is defined.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Jeremy Scahill, and he's the national security correspondent for The Nation. We're talking about his reporting on Yemen and his reporting from Yemen. He was there in January. He's also the author of the bestseller from a few years ago, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy, let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeremy Scahill. He's the national security correspondent for The Nation. We're talking about Yemen, the targeted U.S. drone attacks against militants and suspected terrorists there, the small military presence that we have in Yemen. Yemen has a group called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, that is kind of an offshoot of al-Qaeda, but it seems like bin Laden didn't really fully endorse it. What is AQAP?
Well, AQAP, I would describe more as an affiliate of al-Qaeda Central. The real direction that al-Qaeda is taking now is to have these sort of regional affiliates that have quite a bit of autonomy. And when bin Laden was in hiding in the last years of his life in Abbottabad, in Pakistan, it appears as though these affiliates started to really take more seriously the idea that they were their own independent show and that they weren't answering to the big boss anymore. And so you saw in 2009, AQAP rise up, and it was jointly founded by Saudis and Yemenis, and they sort of set out to declare the liberation of the Arabian Peninsula. And so there was a far more internally focused agenda in Yemen that also was against the Yemeni government, which was a very unusual position for al-Qaeda. In fact, in the recently released bin Laden notes that were translated and distributed by West Point Military Academy, the Center for Combating Terrorism, you see that bin Laden was frustrated with this and was saying you shouldn't be attacking these Arab governments. You should be focused on the global jihad, on attacking U.S. interests, and was very frustrated with the al-Qaeda leadership in Yemen. This was also true in Somalia, where there is a group called al-Shabaab, which recently pledged its allegiance to al-Qaeda. A lot of frustration from al-Qaeda Central with them. There's al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is in Mali and Mauritania and elsewhere in North Central and Western Africa. So all of these regional nodes for al-Qaeda are sort of semi-autonomous organizations that have their own local agendas, and in a broader sense, some of their operatives are part of the global jihad.
So how successful has al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, been in Yemen, either in its attempts to, you know, undermine the government there or to attack the United States?
I think that with a relatively small amount of money, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has succeeded in shaking into a state of fear the most powerful nation in the world. I think that the U.S. policy in Yemen is a radical overreaction to the proportion of the threat. I think they've been very successful at shaking an empire. And I don't say that with any sense of joy. I say it almost in disbelief that we are so afraid of a few hundred people. And it would be atrocious if an airplane was brought down by an underwear bomber. But let's be clear, this group does not pose an existential threat to the United States, and we are acting as though it does. And I think that's one of the core problems of our response to Yemen. In terms of their success within Yemen itself, I think that unfortunately, U.S. policy and the Yemeni government policy of the past 10 years has created a propaganda bonanza for AQAP to recruit. AQAP has tried to rebrand itself as a sort of Taliban-style movement within Yemen, as declared emirates in certain towns in South Yemen, and has begun providing services that the central government is not: electricity, water, food programs. They're engaged in their own sort of counterinsurgency. And so I think that, you know, we've seen a tripling of the size of the core members of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula from, let's say, 300 or 400 in 2006 to over 1,000 today. And there are also other organizations that, you know, may or may not be directed by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There's one, for instance, Terry, called Ansar al-Sharia, which exists in the south of Yemen, the partisans of Sharia law.
And so they're related to AQAP?
Well, you know, one of the leading AQAP clerics in Yemen a year or so ago gave an interview in which he said that he said effectively that the al-Qaeda brand has been so tarnished around the world that we need to rebrand ourselves. And he began suggesting that the movement in Yemen call itself Ansar al-Sharia, the supporters of Sharia law. And part of the cleverness of it, and bin Laden actually talked about this kind of rebranding himself, is that he didn't want President Obama to be able to say we're at war with al-Qaeda. He wanted him to have to say we're at war with Islam. And so if Obama says, you know, we're at war with the partisans of Sharia law, it sounds like, well, we're at war with your system of laws and governance. And so it was actually quite clever. So there was definitely a suggestion by AQAP people that this be the term used. And then what you saw happen, it was beginning when I was in Yemen in January of this year, is that Ansar al-Sharia was a much larger group than AQAP, started popping up in towns around the south of Yemen. One that I made it into is called Zinjibar. And they began taking over these towns and announcing themselves as the new government. And they actually renamed some of those towns. Now, who are those people that are Ansar al-Sharia? There certainly is a core element from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And no doubt that AQAP is trying to take advantage of the popularity of Ansar al-Sharia. But my understanding from very well-connected Yemen terrorism analysts and also tribal leaders in the south is that Ansar al-Sharia was largely a response to the corruption of the Saleh regime, a response to the attacks by the Saleh regime security forces and the Americans, and that there were many tribes that delegated young people to join these uprisings. So I was told by one well-known Yemeni security analyst that the vast majority of Ansar al-Sharia are angry tribesmen, not AQAP, and that they're operating out of revenge and they're operating out of a sense that the state is done and that they need to build one in their own vision of Islamic Sharia law, which can bring order in chaos. That's essentially their selling point. We'll give you bread, we'll give you electricity, and we'll give you law and order. If someone steals your car, his hand's going to get chopped off. And as opposed to, if someone steals your car, you have to bribe someone to get it back.
That sounds like the Taliban.
It's very much like the Taliban. I mean, I almost never compare any movement to the Taliban, but I do believe that Ansar al-Sharia modeled itself after the Taliban and really is engaged in a campaign of trying to win hearts and minds. And yet, Terry, as you and I are speaking today, there's a war going on in South Yemen that began just a few days ago, where U.S.-backed Yemeni forces have started shelling these places in the south where Ansar al-Sharia has been basically operating as the government. U.S. strikes are targeting the leadership of Ansar al-Sharia as well as people from AQAP. And you have ground battles going on. You have a ground war going on between U.S.-backed Yemeni forces, a smattering of U.S. Soldiers that are alongside them, and these various groups. And who is Ansar al-Sharia? We should be able to answer that question before we declare war against them, because it could be that the vast majority of them are people that are not members of al-Qaeda. And then that raises serious questions about what the U.S. is even doing fighting them.
Now, you said earlier that you thought the United States was perhaps overreacting to the threat posed by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and other terrorists and militants in Yemen. So I just want to ask you about that. First of all, I know that downing a U.S. plane is not an existential threat to the United States, but think of the disruption to American life if planes were downed, if parcel bombs succeeded in exploding and people were afraid to go to the post office, people were afraid to open their own mail. But also, I think one of the U.S. goals is probably to prevent Yemen from becoming the kind of failed state in which al-Qaeda has a home. Al-Qaeda is just like free. And any other, you know, radical Islamist group is free to set up training camps, to recruit, to plot against us, against other Western countries.
Those are all excellent points, and I'm very sympathetic to everything that you said. But let me be clear on what I'm saying here. I believe that what the United States is doing in Yemen right now, in terms of the forces that it's supporting inside of Yemen and the military campaign that it's conducting, is going to make it more likely that Yemen becomes a safe haven for those kinds of groups, is going to make it more likely that you will have an increase in the number of people that would want to participate in such plots against the United States rather than diminishing the threat. I don't want any terrorist attack to happen against the United States. And when I say that I think that we're overreacting, I actually should probably correct myself. I think that we're encouraging the very threats that we claim to be fighting, because we're giving people a legitimate agenda, a reason, motivation to fight the United States. When people have a perception that they are under attack, they bond together. And I think that that's what we are doing right now. We're uniting internal enemies with each other against us inside of Yemen. And that to me is a very, very frightening scenario. But if you want to ask me on a technical level, Terry, because I think it's important that you're pointing this out, on a technical level, what would I do or what do I think should be done to address the fact that someone wants to bring down an airplane over the United States and blow up hundreds of U.S. citizens with an underwear bomb? What should we do about that? Well, I think drone strikes is not going to solve it. I think killing a bomb maker in Yemen may mean that man will never make a bomb again, but there are many others like him who will step in and take his place. We have a dearth of intelligence on the ground in Yemen. We have outsourced our intelligence operations to the Saudis, who have their own agenda, and the Yemeni government and the Saleh family that has its own agenda. And so if we don't take seriously the fact that technology is not a replacement for human intelligence, we are going to be more vulnerable than ever. And I think that is the real crisis in Yemen. We don't have good intelligence.
Do you have any sources in the CIA or the military who agree with the conclusion you've just made?
Absolutely. I am I'm certainly no hawk. You know, I regularly am in debates with with people from the sort of pro-war side of the aisle, and I am stunned by the number of people that I know within both the special operations community and the intelligence community who are saying, "I think that our policy is failing in Yemen." You know, I think people in the military, and particularly in particular in the special operations world, are very concerned about what they're seeing happen now in Yemen, because their job is to be the premier counterterrorism force of the United States. And they've watched over this decade as the threats in some of these countries have grown rather than diminished. And I'm not saying that these people are signing off 100% on everything I say, but there are echoes of what I said and what I hear from them. And part of what I'm saying to you is informed by my discussions with people who work on Yemen for the U.S. military and for the intelligence community.
Who is creating the policy in Yemen? Is that coming directly from the White House or the CIA, the military? Like, who?
You know, I think, the honest answer is I don't know. But my best sense from the analysis and from the reporting that I've done and the analysis that I've heard from people within government and military is that John Brennan is the chief driver of U.S. policy toward Yemen. Of course, when he was in the CIA, was in Saudi Arabia. He spent a tremendous amount of time working on Saudi and Yemeni issues in the intelligence community and in government. And I think he's really driving that policy.
I'm just going to interrupt you and say that he's the Obama administration's chief counterterrorism official.
Yes, of course. As far as on an agency level, I would say that there has been friction between the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command over who is supposed to be taking the lead in combating terrorism in Yemen. And that has created sort of leak wars, where you'll have leaks that appear in Washington Post or other media outlets that are intended to sort of imply that the CIA should be given more supremacy over the military in terms of those operations. I think it's a bit of a divided community. But the single official, I think, most responsible for driving this policy would in fact be John Brennan.
My guest is Jeremy Scahill, the national security correspondent for The Nation. We'll talk about some of his experiences reporting from Yemen after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeremy Scahill, the national security correspondent for The Nation. We've been talking about the terrorist threat to the U.S. from militants in Yemen and the increasing U.S. drone attacks and military presence in Yemen. So you spent some time in Yemen in January. You've said it took you like 3 years to get a visa in order to get in. A lot of the reporting I've been reading about Yemen comes from a report is based in Washington, and it's about Washington policy in Yemen. There hasn't been, I think it's fair to say, there hasn't been that much on the ground reporting from Yemen. Would you agree with that?
There hasn't been, and it's part of it is because the Yemenis stopped letting journalists in after 2009, when the underwear plot first happened. They basically shut the country down, and it was very difficult for journalists to get in. So many of the journalists who report from the ground there are very young Arabic students who are really learning as they go journalism, and some of them have done fantastic. Iona Craig is an amazing reporter. Adam Barron is a fantastic reporter. Laura Kasanoff of the New York Times, great reporter. And there's a handful of them, and that's it. And Yemen is sort of a forgotten country that if we ignore it, we do so at our own peril, I think.
Tell us something else about your reporting on the ground that you think you couldn't have learned if you weren't there.
Wow, that's an interesting question. Well, I know my mom listens to your show, and she probably won't like to hear this, but I really enjoyed chewing the drug khat in Yemen. and I don't mind if this is on the air, because I also have a point to make about this. So they have this sort of narcotic-like leaf that is chewed throughout the Horn of Africa and in parts of the Arabian Peninsula. And almost every Yemeni chews it. And it's funny, because you see all these half-done construction projects all over Yemen. And part of the reason why is that people get up, around 7 o'clock or so. They go to work. By 10 o'clock, they're talking to each other about which kind of cot leaves they're going to chew. By noon, they've sent someone to go and get their cot leaves, or they have gotten them themselves. And by 2 o'clock, people have a pouch full of khat in their mouth, and they're sitting in tea houses or in diwans in their living rooms, and they're chewing khat and they're talking about the world. And they call it building castles in the sky. And so I went to so many katchus. I went to katchus with senior Yemeni officials, with Saleh's inner circle. I went to katchus with members of the U.S.-backed security forces there. I went to katchus with pro-Al-Qaeda figures. I went to katchus with tribal leaders. And you sit there and you talk to people for 8 hours. And it's people argue and they agree and they laugh and they sing. And it's you have a window into this incredible ritual in Yemen that is such a big part of their lives. And I would not have gotten access to the places I went. I wouldn't have been able to talk to the people that I did. I wouldn't have been able to travel as freely as I did in Yemen if I wasn't going to those katchus and negotiating permissions or talking to people and listening to them. And the reason that I'm so struck by that experience is because the United States bans its employees in Yemen from chewing cot. Every other government allows its ambassadors and other diplomatic figures to go to katchus. That's where you learn everything in Yemen, is at a katchu. No one's going to send you an email telling you anything. You have to go to a katchu, sit on the floor, and chew with people into the night. And that's how you get intelligence. That's how you get permission. That's how you get anything done.
So you brought it up. Describe what the high is like.
I would say that it's an upper. It opens up incredible kind of creative circuits in your brain. You sometimes find yourself talking very fast. You find yourself becoming completely just intertwined with someone else's story that they're telling and imagining it, and your imagination becomes vivid. And you also start to make grand plans with people. We're going to do this. Well, many a meal was planned as I was talking, you know, chewing cot. It's like tomorrow night we're all going to do this, and you know we don't do it, but it's like it's an imagination.
So, do you think that being high on cot affected your reporting? I mean, obviously, it gave you sources you wouldn't otherwise have. It gave you information you wouldn't have otherwise had. It might have affected your interpretation of what you were getting.
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, one of the reasons we started chewing cot when I was there is because we found that we couldn't get anything done because everyone would close down for business at 2 o'clock and we couldn't get any interviews with anyone. So once we started going to cot chews, we could book interviews with people for the morning. And you know, when we were completely sober, I wasn't doing formal interviews with people while chewing cot. I was arranging things, but you know, I definitely recorded a lot of conversations when we were chewing cot, and they were very interesting. And when I got back, I went through all of my notes. So I really think it had a positive impact on the reporting. But I understand why you're asking. I mean, if someone was running around the United States on LSD and then said, "Hey, here's my serious reporting," you'd say, "Well, come on."
Oh, exactly. Well, Jeremy Scahill, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jeremy Scahill is national security correspondent for The Nation. You'll find links to his articles on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. John Sheehan directed today's show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.